Last week, we revisited the overall theme of the Sermon on the Mount, which is the true fulfillment of the law, especially contrasted with the pretensions of the religious hypocrites who held themselves up as the example of law fulfillment, but in reality were leading the people quite wrong in making them think that God was concerned with outward behavior instead of the attitudes and motives of their hearts. And this is what Jesus keeps coming back to throughout the Sermon on the Mount, is exposing the hypocrisy of those that were outwardly religious and teaching us what it really means to fulfill God's commandments from the heart. And as we went through and recapped chapters 5 and 6, we saw that there were themes, a kind of a sub-theme with each section. At the beginning in chapter 5, Jesus gave us the character profile of a kingdom heir as contrasted with the Pharisees and their profile that they portrayed themselves as being very godly, but in reality, all the things that Jesus described were quite the opposite of everything that they stood for. We saw in the latter half of chapter 5 how he dealt with the true meaning of the law, going through specific commandments that he gave as examples and how they're truly fulfilled. In the first part of chapter 6, we saw how he taught us about what true devotion to God looks like in prayer, fasting, and charitable deeds, as opposed to doing those things merely to be seen by men. And in the last half of chapter 6, he dealt with the matter of worldly goods and of the things that are desirable in this life, or appear desirable, and what a kingdom perspective on those things looks like, in generosity and a lack of worry and anxiety over our physical provision. And we began chapter 7 last week in studying this command that he gave us, judge not. But we have not yet really seen what the theme of this part of the sermon is, what the sub-theme under the heading of true fulfillment of the law, what the theme of these verses might be. So I'm going to start again with verse 1 and read what I take to be a complete section, which goes through verse 12. Judge not that you be not judged. For with what judgment you judge, you will be judged, and with the measure you use, it will be measured back to you. And why do you look at the speck in your brother's eye, but do not consider the plank in your own eye? Or how can you say to your brother, let me remove the speck from your eye, and look, a plank is in your own eye? Hypocrite, first remove the plank from your own eye, and then you will see clearly to remove the speck from your brother's eye. Do not give what is holy to the dogs, nor cast your pearls before swine, lest they trample them under their feet, and turn and tear you in pieces. Ask, and it will be given to you. Seek, and you will find. Knock, and it will be opened to you. For everyone who asks receives, and he who seeks finds, and to him who knocks, it will be opened. Or what man is there among you who, if his son asks for bread, will give him a stone? Or if he asks for a fish, will he give him a serpent? If you then, being evil, know how to give good gifts to your children, how much more will your Father who is in heaven give good gifts, give good things to those who ask him? Therefore, whatever you want men to do to you, do also to them, for this is the law and the prophets. So we talked about how the word therefore is like a road sign. It points back to what was just said as an explanation of what is about to be said. So it's a very useful word whenever you find it in Scripture, in your study. Stop and ask, what does that mean, therefore? How does this thought that goes before lead to that thought that comes after? This is a particularly perplexing therefore in light of those facts. In fact, I know that when I've read the Sermon on the Mount previously, I've sort of tripped over it. It's like, wait a minute, therefore, whatever you want men to do to you, do to them? He's just got through saying we need to ask and seek and knock, and that sounds like more like what I want for myself and not what I do to other people. So how does all this make sense? Well, I think the way that we can make sense of this is by seeing this whole passage of Matthew 7:1 through 7:12 as a single section that is all about one thing, and that thing is defined by the word therefore. Therefore, whatever you want men to do to you, do also to them. So what Jesus is dealing with in verses 1 through 12 is our relationship to other people. It's how we reach out to people and fulfill God's law by showing love to them. And that might not be clear, but I think you'll see as we go through this how all this comes together. So we're actually going to start with the conclusion. We're going to look at the conclusion first, and then we're going to look at what leads up to it and how all of these ideas fit together to lead to this conclusion. And this conclusion is commonly known as the Golden Rule. Whatever you want men to do to you, do to them. Jesus makes a rather startling claim. He says, "This is the law and the prophets." Now, if you've read the Old Testament, then you know that there's a lot in the Law and the Prophets that doesn't appear to pertain directly to the Golden Rule, right? Because there's a lot in the Law and the Prophets where God is talking about his people's relationship to himself and their wanderings into idolatry. And there's a lot of rules about remaining clean and not eating unclean animals. And there's just a lot of things in the Law and the Prophets that we would think, well, they don't really have anything to do with doing to others as you would have them do to you. However, what we find in the scripture is the principle that our relationship with other people cannot be divorced from our relationship to God, nor vice versa. There is no such thing as having a right relationship, a truly right relationship, with another human being separate from a relationship with God. Nor is there any such thing as having a right relationship with God that is separate from a right relationship with other humans. And we find this in 1 John chapter 4. I'm going to read a couple verses from there. Verse 20, John says, "If someone says, 'I love God,' and hates his brother, he is a liar." That's a pretty strong word. He did not say, whoever says, "I love God," and hates his brother is misguided and needs some additional teaching. He said he's a liar. An intentional misrepresenter of the truth is what that means. If someone says, "I love God," and hates his brother, he's a liar. He pretends to love God, he claims to love God, but he actually does not. And this is what a hypocrite is. It's an actor, someone who claims to love God, but does not, in fact, love God. He is a liar. "For he who does not love his brother whom he has seen, how can he love God whom he has not seen? And this commandment we have from him, that he who loves God must love his brother also." So we see that the relationships that we have with other people are so intertwined with our relationship with God that one can actually stand for the other. Jesus can say that to do to others as you would have them do to you is the essence of the message of the law and the prophets, because you cannot truly do that if you do not love God, just as you cannot truly love God if you do not love your neighbor. So that is why Jesus was able to say, on these two hang the law and the prophets. Love the Lord your God with all your heart, soul, mind, and strength, and love your neighbor as yourself. Those are two sides of one coin that cannot be separated, and on those the entire message of the law and the prophets hangs. We can also find an example even in the prophets. You may have noticed that the prophets often talked about justice. They did not just call the people back from idolatry. They spoke of executing justice. There was a lack of that going on in Israel. And it was not a coincidence that when the people wandered from the worship of the true God into idolatry, that at the same time they oppressed their neighbors. In Jeremiah chapter 7, beginning in verse 1, it says, "The word that came to Jeremiah from the Lord, saying, 'Stand in the gate of the Lord's house and proclaim there this word, and say, Hear the word of the Lord, all you of Judah, who enter in at these gates to worship the Lord. Thus says the Lord of hosts, the God of Israel, amend your ways and your doings, and I will cause you to dwell in this place. Do not trust in these lying words, saying, The temple of the Lord, the temple of the Lord, the temple of the Lord are these. For if you thoroughly amend your ways and your doings, if you thoroughly execute judgment between a man and his neighbor, if you do not oppress the stranger, the fatherless, and the widow, and do not shed innocent blood in this place or walk after other gods to your hurt, then I will cause you to dwell in this place in the land that I gave to your fathers forever and ever. Behold, you trust in lying words that cannot profit. Will you steal, murder, commit adultery, swear falsely, burn incense to Baal, and walk after other gods whom you do not know? And then come and stand before me in this house which is called by my name and say, 'We are delivered to do all these abominations.' Has this house, which is called by my name, become a den of thieves in your eyes? Behold, I, even I, have seen it, says the Lord. It's not too surprising that some people thought that Jesus was actually Jeremiah. Because if you look at the message that he preached, it is very similar in some respects, and even to some of the things that he did when he cleansed the temple, when he drove out the money changers, he used the same language. He said, it is written, my house is to be called the house of prayer. You have made it a den of robbers. He was alluding to the prophecy of Jeremiah. Because what they were doing was precisely what is described here. They were not keeping God's commandments. They were not loving their neighbors. They were claiming, when they came into the temple of God, that they were delivered to do these abominations, that somehow the sacrificial system that they were so careful to observe absolved them from their guilt of not keeping God's commandments. God is very clear. This is not cutting it. You cannot do all these things and then come into my house and claim to love me. You don't love me. You're not loving your neighbors. You know, notice, idolatry is actually the last on both lists. So when he talks about the things that they're doing and the things that they need to do to reverse those evil deeds, idolatry is last in both cases. Have you ever wondered why it was that the Israelites were so addicted to the worship of false gods? Was it just because they liked the name Baal better than Jehovah? I don't think so. I don't even think it was necessarily because they wanted to worship an idol of stone instead of worshiping the true and immortal God. I believe the reason that people gravitate to idolatry is because they want a God who approves of them. And if I can make the God, then I can make my God approve of whatever it is I want to do. I don't have to worry about what the true God says about needing to die to myself and my desires and to love my neighbor as myself. I don't have to worry about that. I'll just get a God who says I can do whatever I want. And you don't have to look far to see that in our country today. To see places where you can go, having done whatever abominable thing you want, and find someone who will tell you Jesus approves because God is love and that's all there is to it. And that is a false gospel. And that is exactly what the Jews of Jeremiah's day had fallen for. And that is why he had to stand in the temple and say, no, this is not pleasing to God. And that is why Jesus came to say, this is how you truly keep the law. Not the way the Pharisees are teaching you, but from your heart. This is how you love your neighbor as yourself. And that's basically what the golden rule is a restatement of that command to love your neighbor as yourself. Because obviously we take the best care of ourselves than we do of anyone. We know what things we would like to be done to us, how we'd like other people to understand us, to listen to us, to respect us, all the things that we want to happen. We know. All we have to do is turn that around and apply it to others. But that's surprisingly hard to do because we're very flawed and broken people. We might be able to make the choice to not hate someone or not do evil to someone, but when it comes to proactively loving someone else the way we love ourselves, that's another matter entirely. And love is an action. It is not a feeling. So, how is that even possible for us? Because we are broken and fallen human creatures, how can we keep this command to love your neighbors yourself, to do to others as you would have them to do to you? We're not even really capable of analyzing ourselves, as Jesus has just said, you know, you got a plank in your eye. How could we possibly even know where to start? Jesus said the things that are impossible with men are possible with God. And remember, we're looking at a conclusion here. Therefore, whatever you want men to do to you, do to them, for this is the law and the prophets. So we've got a road sign. So let's follow the road sign. Let's go back to the beginning of chapter 7. Judge not that you be not judged. For with what judgment you judge, you will be judged, and with the measure you use, it will be measured back to you. And why do you look at the speck in your brother's eye, but do not consider the plank in your own eye? Or how can you say to your brother, let me remove the speck from your eye, and look, a plank is in your own eye? Hypocrite! First remove the plank from your own eye, and then you will see clearly to remove the speck from your brother's eye. So remember, Jesus is not telling us, don't worry about the speck in your brother's eye. He's telling us how to worry about it, how to address the flaw or the sin we see in someone else, which is first to get that plank of self-love out of my own eye. So what he is doing is he is dealing with fallacies. Actually, what I hope to bring out is that there are two major fallacies that Jesus is dealing with in the way that we deal with others, whom we think we are trying to help. In our view, we are acting out of love to, I want to help this person, but there are two major fallacies that we fall prey to. And the first fallacy is judgment, condemnation, hypocritical imposing of our own standards on people. This is what we looked at last week. It is the fallacy that causes us to invent our own standards to judge people by and to condemn them for what we perceive as their failures while ignoring our own. And this proceeds from a lack of love. There is a lack of love that causes us to care more about how this guy's failure makes me feel or makes me look, maybe, that I look better because he looks worse. And Jesus teaches us how to avoid this fallacy of judging in an ungodly way, in a hypocritical way, by getting the plank out of our eye. Once again, getting rid of that agenda of self-love. And this is precisely what Jesus modeled as far as speaking the truth in love when he dealt with the Pharisees, when he dealt with everyone around him. Because there was no plank in his eye. Because he came with pure love, and that is why he could say the things, as we looked at last week, the very strong words that he had for the Pharisees that were nevertheless not condemnation, but words of warning. So in dealing with others, we must avoid that fallacy of hypocritical judging by being set free from self-love to really love others the way that God does. The second fallacy is a little bit less obvious. In fact, this verse was very troubling to me this week, or troubling is probably not the right word. Troublesome? It really had me foxed. Like, I stopped there for a reason. Because you get to verse 6 and he says this, "Do not give what is holy to the dogs, nor cast your pearls before swine, lest they trample them under their feet and turn and tear you in pieces." What is that doing here? Like, what is he even talking about? And why is it in between this part about judging and this part about asking, seeking, and knocking? It was not making sense to me. And I thought about it for a few days. And I guess it was it yesterday morning or Thursday morning? Friday morning or Saturday morning. I was walking, and finally I just said to the Lord, "Would you please tell me what this means?" And believe it or not, he actually did. That's a silly thing to say. Obviously, you should not ask without expecting to receive, and I do expect to receive. This has happened to me many times. And it's a really exhilarating experience when you go to the Lord with something that you're just like, "I have no idea what this means." And you get a revelation. And you're like, "Wow, that's amazing. That actually makes sense now." So what I used to think of when I read this was there are certain people in the world that God knows are just not going to be receptive to the gospel or not receptive to whatever message you have. And you shouldn't waste your time and energy trying to share with those people because it will not be appreciated and it may actually cause them to attack you. That's plausible, okay? I'm not saying that people that teach this way are wrong. But I am saying that within the context of this, I don't believe that's what Jesus had in mind. Because what does that lead us to do? Very likely, it may lead us to stay away from people that react with hostility when we preach the gospel and just say, "Well, they're swine. I'm not going to cast my pearls before them." But is this what Jesus did? What about his talking to the Pharisees? What about his saying, warning the Pharisees of the judgment that was in store for them? Was that not casting his pearls before swine? I mean, they're the people, the priests and the scribes, the ones that nailed him to the cross. He clearly was not violating his own command. So I don't really think that that's what's in view here. In view of the whole message of this passage, which is telling us how to love people, especially people that are not in a good place, how can we reach out to them? I believe that what he's dealing with here is the fallacy of moralism. So who are the dogs and the pigs in this miniature parable, this analogy? I think the answer is all of us without Christ. Isaiah says we are all as an unclean thing, and all our righteousnesses are as filthy rags. Dogs and pigs are unclean animals. You are not supposed to throw holy things to dogs. You're supposed to throw unclean things, like an animal that had died of itself in the law of Moses. The Jews couldn't eat that, but they could throw it to the dogs. So that was the fit food for dogs. There's nothing wrong with them being dogs. That's how they were made. They're just not a holy creature. And the same was true of pigs. A pig was not something that they were supposed to have anything to do with. And obviously, a pig is not an animal that can appreciate pearls. The point that Jesus is making is not that there are certain people who are unworthy of our time and attention because they're fundamentally incompatible with the message of the gospel. It is that there are certain things that are not going to be appreciated, understood, or assimilated by people who are in a certain place. You cannot skip over steps and simply take the truths of the kingdom and try to apply them to people who are not regenerate. Later on in Matthew, Jesus encounters a Gentile. This is in Matthew chapter 15, beginning in verse 21. Now you will recall that Jesus said that his mission was to the Jews, that is, to those who already had a relationship with God to a limited extent through the faith of Abraham. So he was not going to the Gentiles, but a Gentile came to him. It says in verse 21 that Jesus went out from there and departed to the region of Tyre and Sidon. And behold, a woman of Canaan came from that region and cried out to him, saying, "Have mercy on me, O Lord, Son of David, my daughter is severely demon-possessed." But he answered her not a word. And his disciples came and urged him, saying, "Send her away, for she cries out after us." But he answered and said, "I was not sent except to the lost sheep of the house of Israel." Then she came and worshipped him, saying, "Lord, help me." But he answered and said, "It is not good to take the children's bread and throw it to the little dogs." So what was he saying? That there's a class of people over here that are worthy of God's grace, and then there's another class of people over here who are not? None of us is worthy. We're all dead in trespasses and sins. This is not racism. This is a simple acknowledgement of the fact that there are certain people for whom this is the right thing, and then there are certain people for whom this is not the right thing. And the Gentiles were in a different class because they did not have the heritage of faith of Abraham. They had no frame of reference to be able to even understand the gospel yet, because Jesus had not died and risen. So this was not the time for the gospel to be preached to the Gentiles. Jesus put it in a way that created a stumbling block for this woman, because there are other analogies he could have used. And in the Middle East, to call someone a dog is about the worst insult that you can give. So he was presenting a challenge to her faith and saying something that sounded an awful lot like, "You're not a child, you're a dog." Sorry. So I got to watch those gestures. "So why are you coming to me? I'm not going to take the children's bread and give it to dogs." And her response stands all time as one of the most amazing examples of faith that will not be denied. And she said, "Yes, Lord. Yet even little dogs eat the crumbs which fall from their master's table." Then Jesus answered and said to her, "O woman, great is your faith. Let it be to you as you desire." And her daughter was healed from that very hour. You know what she had? She had the faith of Abraham. Even though she was a Gentile, she had the faith of Abraham, and Jesus saw that. And if you look at this example, the other example of a Gentile that he encountered and did something for, the centurion, you'll see he said the same thing. He said, "Your faith is great." There was faith there. And because there was faith there, there was a capacity for him to do something that he didn't normally do, which was to reach out to a Gentile, someone with no background, and give them that goodness of God that would lead them into a fuller relationship with him. So Jesus did not teach one thing and do another. He did not give what was holy to dogs. He gave what was holy to someone who had faith and showed, therefore, that they were in a position to receive it. So what does it really mean to make the mistake that he's talking about? The fallacy that he's talking about, I believe, is the fallacy of trying to get carnal people to keep God's law. And if you want examples of moralism, they're not hard to find. You will find them all over Christian societies. Because there is this impulse that we have, and sometimes there's a good aspect to it. Sometimes there is a motive that is actually like, if we just help people to get them off drugs or to get them off of alcohol or teach them to live in a more moral way and all these things, that they would be benefited by that. We'd have a better society, we could pass some good laws, and everybody would be happier. That may be true in the short term. And I'm not saying there's anything wrong with good laws, I'm not saying there's anything wrong with getting people off of drugs and alcohol. What I am saying is that when you try to bring the law of God and the fruits of kingdom, of being a child of the kingdom, and you try to insert those into the lives of people who are not regenerate, the result is not going to be a good one. I never realized this until I was studying this passage, but there's a more modern saying that is actually parallel to, if not derived from, Jesus' statement about casting pearls before swine. You may have heard this saying. It goes something like, don't try to teach a pig to dance because you'll get dirty and the pig will get mad. It's an exercise in futility, and it's not only an exercise in futility, it actually has negative consequences. Moralism is the opposite error from judgment. So judgment and condemnation is looking at the faults in others and condemning them for it, or even inventing new standards so that you can find someone guilty of something you don't think you're guilty of. Moralism is the opposite to that. Moralism is looking at the real faults in their life and saying, let me fix that for you. Except that I can't fix that for you. There is only one who can give you a new heart, which has to precede any outward change in your life. And that is Jesus Christ. I cannot come to you and say, here's a list of three or four things that if you get these right, you would really be acceptable to God. That would be like taking a pig and putting him in a tuxedo and saying, why don't you come to my wedding? That's not going to end well. Even though moralism is opposite from judgment, it actually results in some of the same outcomes, and they're not good outcomes. When moralists are successful, they make new hypocrites. Because what they're doing is teaching people to fake it. They're basically telling people, if you dress up the outside, then you can blend right in with God's people and no one will ever know you're fake. When moralists fail, they make raging rebels. And this is what Jesus meant when he said, don't cast your pearls before swine, because they'll trample them under their feet and they'll turn and rend you. And you can see this in legalistic homes where the kids have been given rules but never had their heart led into a relationship with Jesus Christ. They turn into raging rebels and they go against everything that their parents... I know of one young man in particular, I've mentioned it before, and I won't say his name, obviously, but... And I don't even know for certain that this is the way that he was raised, but he's reacting against something, and he's declared himself an atheist, and he just goes on social media trying to provoke his parents, trying to say things that will offend them. And I believe that this is because this is what's happened. When you attempt to impose morality on a person, whether that person is your child or someone else, we've seen this in society. There was an era in American history in the late 19th century, usually referred to as the Victorian era. There was a great deal of morality imposed. We had probably the best outward national morals that we've had at any time in our history. But what happened? The 1920s happened. Everyone threw off all restraint, and it was worse than it ever was before. Because it didn't come from the heart. No one's heart was changed. And this is where I think people are very misguided when they start talking about redeeming the culture or law, changing laws. That's not going to change anyone's heart. People's lives change from the inside out. If that change is permanent, if that change is worked by the Holy Spirit, it starts at the inside and it goes out. It never comes from the outside and works its way in. Never. And surprise, surprise, this is exactly what the Pharisees did. They wanted to effect change on the outside. Jesus said in Matthew 23, verses 25 through 26, "Woe to you, scribes and Pharisees, hypocrites! For you cleanse the outside of the cup and dish, but inside they are full of extortion and self-indulgence. Blind Pharisee, first cleanse the inside of the cup and dish, that the outside of them may be clean also." And this is true of ourselves personally, that we focus on the inner life that works its way out into the externalities, not on the outer things, and worry about the attitudes and motives later. God deals with the heart and with its motives and attitudes first. And then that works its way out into every part of our life until every thought is captive and every part of our life is glorifying to Christ. And it's the same with those we're trying to help. It has to start with the heart. But this is not what the Pharisees did. In verse 15 of the same chapter, Jesus said, "Woe to you, scribes and Pharisees, hypocrites, for you travel land and sea to win one proselyte, and when he is won, you make him twice as much a son of hell as yourselves." The Pharisees, with their moralism, were making hypocrites. Where they succeeded, they made a hypocrite worse than themselves. A hypocrite who would go around judging others, who would make standards for others. So it never ends well. It either ends in raging rebellion or in stinking hypocrisy. To try to impose morality, the fruits of the Spirit, the fruits of kingdom living, in the life of someone whose heart has not been changed. And like judgment, moralism ultimately comes from a lack of love. Because if you truly love someone, you're not going to give them a band-aid for their cancer. You're not going to just try to dress up the outside so that they look good. Why do we do that? Well, like I said, I think there are some good motives at work that are misguided, but I think a big part of it is we want results that we can see and measure. We would rather be able to say, yeah, we got 100 people off alcohol and got them to fill the church pews because I can measure that. I can take a picture. I can't necessarily take a picture of someone's heart. So that it may be about me making myself feel better about what I've accomplished, rather than really addressing that person's need. Because if you bring them the truth and love, they may hate you. If you just give them a way to clean up the outside, they may be fine with that. But if you really bring them the truth and love, you may never be the one to see the fruit. They may kick you out of their life and never speak to you again. But maybe, just maybe, you sowed a seed. And maybe the day will come when that bears fruit. And it will be in your account in the world to come. Nobody may ever notice you for it here. You may never get a write-up in Time magazine. Look at this wonderful humanitarian and all the great works he did in India and all the wells he drilled and how he brought civilization to all of these savages. That probably isn't going to happen. But if you have converted a sinner from the error of his ways, you've saved a soul from death and hidden a multitude of sins. It's worth doing. But we cannot fall into moralism. We cannot fall into judgment. So what do we do? What's the right answer? What leads to the therefore of golden rule living where we're doing to others what we'd have them do to us? Surprisingly, the answer actually has to do with receiving. And we would assume that it would have something to do with giving, because this is all about how we relate to other people and how we help those that, especially those that have spiritual need. So returning to Matthew 7, this is how Jesus answers the question. Ask, and it will be given to you. Seek, and you will find. Knock, and it will be opened to you. For everyone who asks receives, and he who seeks finds, and to him who knocks it will be opened. Or what man is there among you who, if his son asks for bread, will give him a stone? Or if he asks for fish, will he give him a serpent? If you then, being evil, know how to give good gifts to your children, how much more will your Father who is in heaven give good things to those who ask him? Therefore, whatever you want men to do to you, do also to them, for this is the law and the prophets. People do not need your judgment. They do not need your moralism. What they need is the same as what you need, only you know where to find it and they don't. So if you want to be a good giver, the first thing you have to learn to do is be a good receiver. I have heard it said that the gospel is one beggar telling another where to find bread. But if you are not connected to that source, then how are you going to be able to hook anyone else up with it? But here's the amazing thing. If you are connected, it's going to happen. And you may not even be aware of it. You may not even realize how the love of God, the selfless, sacrificial love of God, will flow through you to other people and be just what they need at the moment they need it. You may look at someone's life and go, I have no idea where to even start. They're a complete mess. I mean, they believe this wrong, and they've done this wrong, and they don't understand this, and all these things that are wrong. And this is where we start getting into judgment and moralism and trying to untangle. It's not your job. It is not your job to untangle the knot. That's God's job, and he's the only one who can do it because he made them and he understands them, and you don't. But what can we do? We can be a conduit. And what does a conduit do? It stays connected. Because the flow is not coming from me. The flow is coming from somewhere else. Paul says this in 1 Corinthians, and I thought I'd written down the reference. Actually didn't. I think it might have been 4. He said, "For what? Who makes you differ from another? And what do you have that you did not receive? Now, if you did indeed receive it, why do you boast as though you had not received it?" Paul's talking about spiritual gifts, and he's talking about how the Corinthians tended to take pride in the gifts that they had. But what is he saying? Every gift that you have to share with someone else, you first received. So there is no such thing as a gift that comes from me. I cannot take pride in it, but then I also have to remember that I have to be continually receiving in order to have something to give. I was thinking this morning about radios. A radio is an interesting household appliance because there are some household appliances that are pretty useful on their own. A toaster, for instance, can make toast. A radio, even if it's plugged into the wall, if it's not tuned into the station, it's not accomplishing anything. It basically is totally dependent on the fact that there are radio stations out there broadcasting. If there were not radio stations out there broadcasting, there'd be no reason to have a radio. And your life is kind of like a radio. Because a radio takes radio waves that are inaudible to the human ear. You cannot touch it. You cannot taste it. You can't smell it. If you don't have the right electronic equipment, you wouldn't even know it was there. But a radio takes that and it translates that radio wave into something that you can experience as a human, which is sound. If a radio is not tuned into the station, it produces static. And there are a lot of staticky Christians. And I have been one. Paul says, if I don't have love, then I am like a sounding gong or clanging cymbal. In other words, a sound with no meaning. Which is what static is. It's just noise. So if you are trying to straighten people out or fix people or do what's right for people, but you're not connected to that source, you're not tuned into that station, then you're just producing static. And they're not hearing anything that connects with them or helps them in their lives at all. It's just noise. I've seen this in the way that I've tried to help people before, which is from my own mind and my own thoughts of, I think this is what you need. How do I know what you need? I'm a flawed and broken person like you are. I have no idea what you need. But I know who you need. And I know how to get you connected with him. Because as Christians, we actually have God's frequency. The people who are not born again don't have it. Paul says that the natural man, the carnal man, cannot receive the things of the Spirit of God. It's exactly like throwing pearls in front of pigs. A pig's going to nibble at it, they're going to discover they can't eat it, and then they're going to stomp on it. What do they care? The carnal man cannot receive the things of the Spirit of God, but the spiritual man can. Because he has that radio receiver that God has given him to be able to take the love of God, which you can't see, you can't hear, you can't taste, you can't weigh it on a pair of scales. But it's real. And if we've encountered it, if we're tuned in to God's frequency, then we can translate that into something that they can't understand. We can translate that into action. And you may not always know what that's supposed to look like. And that's why Jesus says, keep asking, keep seeking, keep knocking. Paul talks in his letter to Timothy about people who desire to be teachers of the law. And they're leading people down the wrong track because they're interested in having followers. They want to be listened to. They want to be thought well of. And I think it was Zach Poonen who said, don't worry about being a teacher. Be a student. Don't worry about leading. Be a follower. Paul said to the people who followed him, you follow me as I follow Christ. He wasn't looking behind him to see how big a following he had. His eyes were on Jesus. If you're looking to have something to give, then tune your receiver in. Be so fixed on Christ and so full of him that wherever you go, people can't help but encounter him because he's in you. If we look at the needs of this world, we will be overwhelmed. I know, because I do it all the time and I'm overwhelmed all the time. But if we look to Christ, if we are asking and seeking and knocking, then we are going to be able to love people the way that God loves them because he will be loving them through us. And we don't have to know. We don't have to understand. We don't have to judge. We don't have to bring the outward morality. We just have to be a channel of Jesus Christ and let God love those people through us.